Welcome to this podcast from Barlow McCarthy. We hope you find insight and a catalyst for change in the topics we discuss. Now here is today's presentation.
In today's podcast, I'm happy to welcome Jeff Brickman, who is founder and managing partner with Next Health Advisors, a consultancy he started in August of 2021. Previous to this, Jeff has had several leadership executive positions where he was president and chief executive officer, including Central Maine Healthcare in Lewiston, Maine, Centura Health Mountains, North Denver in Lakewood, Colorado, Provena Health in Joliet, Illinois, and Meridian Health in Wall, New Jersey. In these organizations, Jeff had a successful track record in achieving revenue, profit, and business growth objectives within rapid growth and turnaround change environments. Thanks, Jeff, for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Allison.
Great. So you authored an article in Harvard Business Review that I read, and you noted that change was harder in healthcare than in other industries. Why do you think that is?
Well, healthcare has a very unique power structure between the board, management, and medical staff, and has a lot of stakeholders who believe that they don't answer to any one particular individual. And the only other organizational structure that I find healthcare akin to is probably academics and tenured faculty as they relate to university presidents. And as I've talked to my counterparts over the years in academics, we all have a good laugh about what little authority we really have at the end of the day, us with our medical staff and university leaders with their tenured faculty. And so the political skills of leaders in both academics and healthcare have to be exceptionally strong in order to move an organization where you have to use your ability to influence rather than just top-down command and control. And that's why I think change management is very unique in healthcare. It requires some exceptional communication and other soft skills, along with the technical skills of being a leader in healthcare.
So as physicians move into those leadership positions now, which seems to be coming through more and more, what's important that they almost have to unlearn and relearn from their clinical days to be successful?
It's interesting that you say that, Allison. I do a little bit of coaching with physician leaders over the years, and I've taken a number of physician leaders and them developing their careers. And one of the first things I have to share with them is that leadership is a team sport versus what physicians have been taught in medical school, that they're the captain of the ship and that they have to give up some of their responsibility and delegate to others in order to create a strong team around them. And working with them to understand that level of imperative and the long-term benefits to an organization and developing other leaders is one of the most important foundations that I tried to share with them. And then the other key skill level for clinicians is to be able to understand the business language. They bring a lot of clinical skill and credibility, but they also have to be able to translate what their needs are to the lay business leaders. And so I always work with them to make sure they have fundamentals in accounting and finance and economics so that they understand the jargon, they understand the ability to translate their ideas into pure business terms. And if they can get both of those concepts leading through teams and understanding the business foundations, their natural leadership talents usually rise to the top. And then we usually augment all of that by providing a coach or an advisor for them to help them make that transition as they go deeper into their careers.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. And I'm guessing there's, you know, some key roles that are helpful for them to walk into first before they get to that top seat, right? So they have the ability to practice the teamwork and so forth.
Yeah, typically I like to progress my leaders through a version of medical director roles and then VP roles and then CMO roles. So I'm partial towards ED physicians. And after ED physicians, I like primary care ED physicians, I have found, are very good decision makers. They understand the totality of healthcare from top to bottom. I also believe primary care is also in that same type of bucket. They may not be as prone to quick decision making as ED physicians. That's why I give them the edge. Mm-hmm. But their understanding of the total universe is very important to understand. And so depending on what you're looking for, hospital-centric versus an ambulatory-centric leader, your pick between those two subspecialties is usually pretty good. And then you're able to layer onto that teachings and skill development to really help them in their role as a formal business leader.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because those two specialties sort of have the biggest breadth of knowledge of the system, right? Versus a surgeon who's got a much more narrow perspective. So yeah, that makes sense. So one of the things I really want to talk with you about today is about change management, because you clearly have done a lot of that in your career. What do you think are the top two or three most critical skills needed to lead change? Whether that's change in a little department or that's big change, either one.
I think the ability to communicate and create a shared vision to rally people around is exceptionally important. I think the ability to understand and work to engage others in that vision, where there's a team orientation and ability to be collaborative, communicative, and to delegate responsibility in order to create that buy-in right at the grassroots is exceptionally important. And then the ability to develop others at the next level of leadership. Because I say, in order to really be successful, you have to create that shared vision. You have to provide resources. You have to remove obstacles. You have to develop other leaders. And then you have to communicate. And by doing those basics over and over and over again, I find that change is usually sustained. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell in his Tipping Point speaks about the 10% that he infects within an organization. I work with a leader by the name of Phil Harkins, who was our team and my individual executive coach for about 27 years. And we took Gladwell's concept and called it passionate champions. Mm. And by creating an organization with those passionate champions who wanted that future goal and vision as badly, if not even more so than yourself, provided with direction and resources, you're able to take the vision for the organization, your change imperative for the organization, and really give it life through others within the organization. And those others within the organization infect others and really help that vision come alive.
Yeah. And one of the biggest challenges that I've seen, I'd love you to comment on this, is there's a big vision for the organization. And then how does that get translated into individual units so they sync together, right? Because the big vision can feel like such a disconnect from day-to-day world.
Well, the key to making it happen throughout the organization is to make the vision understood at a granular level. And by doing so, creating individual tactics or strategies that are understandable and can be measured and developed at the grassroots level. I think about that famous story in NASA where a visitor came in and asked a janitor what their job was. And he said, "My job was to get someone to the moon." And when you think about healthcare organizations, we're here to take care of other people and help them better in their own ability to maximize their health. We think about everyone's job. So from the housekeeper to the transporter, to the nurse, to the lab tech, the rad tech, the physician, we're all here to provide high quality care. And if we can create those overarching tasks and tactics that then could be tied to that organization's mission to be a five-star organization, to be a leading healthcare organization within the state or in the country, people then can wrap their arms around what their contributions mean and how it all rolls up to that higher vision.
Yeah.
And to make it work, this is the level of communications and checking that has to be done literally every day, every week, every month, and every year, and can't be taken for granted, because not all leaders communicate the same. And so senior leaders have to really reinforce those messages many different ways throughout the course of the day and throughout the course of the year, or it will not sustain itself.
Yeah. So if you could think about a specific example in your career, you don't need to name anything, but you've been in many turnaround situations. So in turnarounds, I think about, you know, it's growing volume, it's reducing cost, you know, kind of a blend of both. If that's the ultimate vision and purpose, then talk to us about trickling it down specifically, tactically.
Well, I'm a big believer in rounding and going into different parts of the organization to ensure that there's a good understanding of what our frontline staff feel, believe, and understand. And by using those techniques, which I wrote about in my Harvard Business Review article, I was able to measure the distance between the stated vision of the organization and the understanding and the practice at the front lines, and then be able to determine what those barriers were between the stated vision and what people were thinking was the vision or lack of vision at the front lines. And taking that very raw set of feedback and then putting it into different buckets, if you will, between staffing, leadership engagement, appropriate tools and resources for the frontline staff to effectively do their job, pay and benefits to aid in recruitment and retention, you're able then to understand what the distracting factors are that are getting in the way of our frontline and believing that there is a higher mission that leadership is engaged with, and that they on the front line are valued components of achieving that mission. By taking that information, then turning around to the very same group of people who shared that with you, and then establishing stated priorities to address those blockers, taking action that can then be seen as attentive to that, communicating that, demonstrating that, you're then able to engage frontline staff in believing that there is an aligned and committed group of leaders who are listening to them. And in return, the engagement and satisfaction follows to then elevate the focus and attention on the more aspirational goals of the organization. And that's something that has to be done day in and day out. The worst thing you can do is have leaders who are disconnected and don't understand the pulse of their organization and what's being done or not being done by others within that organizational structure. Because when that happens, the apathy and the distance grows, and that's where there are significant issues for an organization. And so I always looked at my role kind of being that chief human resource officer, where I was always evaluating the talent, getting a sense of how my leaders were doing. And I can tell you, I knew every day where there were connects and disconnects, and I was able to take that feedback. And I knew more about that organization through the informal levels of communication that I had established through those personal relationships and rounding than many of my leaders did. And I then had to go back and teach and role model to our leaders about how they should lead differently. Yeah. And as we did that, and I spoke about that in my article, we were able to engage our staff, begin to address the issues, and really improve the overall performance of the organization in many, many ways.
Because the common in turnarounds, again, sort of in those scenarios or change environments, you know, the the front line is sort of always in the feeling that they're being asked to do more with less, and that they, I mean, I've even heard physicians say this, you know, then we have to reduce quality and so on and so forth, or time for teaching, time for research, you know, we're cutting. And I'm hearing that that's kind of those issues that you have to pick up on from the front line and work to address them. Otherwise, they create the apathy.
Absolutely. You know, you find out that our leaders may not have the ability to address those concerns as eloquently as they need to. And I find that there are many times where we teach when we're speaking with our frontline staff, defining the national shortages of registered nurses or primary care physicians or medical assistants, and why we're using technology or other provider levels to fill those gaps, and to educate that this is a national trend and it's a trend that won't change for quite some time. And innovative and successful organizations find different ways to meet the needs and doing it differently. And that our focus is still on high quality. Just because we're changing our processes doesn't mean that those basic goals are changed. And that part of our metrics for success will evaluate how successful we are in attaining or even improving that level of quality on a go-forward basis. And when you explain it, and when you provide examples of others who've attempted change, you can see the light bulbs go off, and you can see absolutely the gap in communication that existed between some of the leaders who didn't have that broad picture, didn't understand it at that level of detail, and therefore were unable to explain it at that same level of granularity to the frontline staff. And when you do that, all of a sudden, you see the leaders also come along and said, oh, I guess I should have known that. I should ask some more questions. Maybe it's better to ask for help before I try to wing it and answer questions when maybe I don't have all the details myself. And that's, if you do it correctly, that's where you can also engage and put your leader in a very positive role as you teach and share that information and bring them along with their staff.
So part of the tools and resources that I hear you suggesting is, yes, those are internal metrics that you're using to sort of measure your progress, et cetera.
Yes.
But you're also bringing in outside information, insights, examples, et cetera, that keep them
on the front lines of performance and of best practice. Because the moment we stop learning, we become endangered as a group of leaders and organizations, because the field continues to innovate and to progress in different ways. And unfortunately, in our field, we don't have a good track record of moving quickly enough at times. And we find that organizations, as they struggle, are at their root unable to adapt to change.
Yeah. And the default can tend to be, let's just take out more costs. Let's just reduce costs, or let's try to shift costs in a different way, versus how do we change the actual operation? How do we change the actual system to become different, more efficient, right?
Yes. So I have a colleague of mine who is a senior nurse exec within a very large multi-hospital system in the country. And she and I spoke recently about their approach to solving the nursing shortage. And she's creating a virtual nursing program for bedside care. And it's become so successful that she's bringing it out across that entire multi-hospital system. We've seen artificial intelligence protocols being used more and more to replace the functions of medical assistants and ambulatory care practices. I have a brother who is working with a company who are mining the use of digital images in radiology to replace the Nighthawk radiologists at night by using artificial intelligence software to be able to read those films and to significantly reduce healthcare costs. And I can go on and on with other examples, and those are just a few of the ways in which organizations are adapting and changing their operations in order to keep themselves in a position to provide service and to do it at a lower cost, but still a very high quality level.
Yeah. And in all of that, Jeff, what I hear you bringing back to this change is a sense of hope. I think right now, when, you know, post-COVID particularly, things are very challenging and there's a lot of apathy and a lot of burnout. It feels like that is some of the breath of fresh air that has to come back, is we're not going to do the same old, same old. We're really going to turn this over and look at it very differently now.
I think through periods like the ones in which we have been going through these last 2.5 years really is an opportunity to breed a level of innovation and change for the positive. Why not now? Why not take advantage of a good crisis? Why not use this as a way to experiment? Why not look at this as a way to potentially change our delivery model? Why not look at other partnerships and joint ventures? Because the way in which we have been doing business have proven not to hold up during this period of time.
Right.
So if we're not willing to innovate and take risk, well, then what are we doing? Because you can't cut your way to stability. It just won't work long term.
Yeah. A lot of this, as we talk about that, you know, we're talking at the center of emotion, right? A lot of this is just emotional management, whether it's the individual or it's the collective party. It's the willingness to change, the ability to take the risk to change. It's, yeah. So can you speak to that a little bit?
At the heart of change management, it's about understanding your audience and what they understand, what they believe in, what inspires and motivates them. And if we don't understand that when we connect with folks, we connect at an emotional level and developing those relationships, then we're missing the boat. That's why I use a lot of informal leaders to give me a sense of how the staff is feeling and reacting, what their biggest concerns are, getting those concerns out on the table, addressing them, giving people permission to take risk and not be punished when they do so, try to provide positive reinforcement to really lift people up. That's why I believe the role of leaders is to provide that positive aspirational vision for the organization that gets people excited. When you read books written by Simon Sinek, as an example, he speaks about the why in organizations and why it's important for people's work every day. I believe you get more through people's positive engagement than you do in any other way. So really being able to read the room, people's body language, people's ability to accept what you're trying to say is a critical soft skill of leaders to be able to develop in order to connect effectively.
Which then leads me to, as a leader, you've got to be able to regulate your own reactions and emotions, right? In order to be able to be outwardly focused instead of inwardly reacting. Yeah.
That's why we need to listen more than we speak. That's why we need to be good poker players in terms of trying to take a deep breath and not act in emotional ways when we get frustrated. I always told my leaders, we all get upset, we all get frustrated, but you need to go into your office or outside in the courtyard or anywhere you can go privately, let out your scream, go run, go lift weights, go do whatever you need to, and then get your game face back on, get back into the room and lead in a positive way and focus on the many who want to listen and really try to give that majority group something to latch onto. And for those outliers that you can't change, they don't really want to be there. There's probably a different organization or place for them to be, but don't lose your focus on the 10% who will never get there. Focus on the rest of the organization and lead that organization that wants to be led in a manner that brings them comfort and stability and bring the rest of the organization to that next level.
So it leads me to one last question for you is, you know, we've been talking about leaders' interactions going down. I would love you to comment, though, on leaders managing up, and that can include the CEO who's got a board to manage or a medical staff to manage, but from the manager all the way up. In these change environments, what is their responsibility in this? How they manage their bosses?
Well, I always share with our leaders that we're a team and that when I put together organizations, I start with talent and then I provide them coaching and development to create high-performing teams, and that we're a collection of high-performing teams within our organization with all stated goals that we're all trying to achieve, and that our success contributes to their success and vice versa. And that in any effective teams, to use a sports analogy, we need people who are totally committed to that vision. And that means speaking positively about the organization, both inside and outside the organization. Because quite frankly, if you can't do so, the question is, why are you in your position? You know, you've got to bring that level of excitement and engagement every day. It's infectious. And if you can't channel that in a very authentic manner, then we have to question whether or not the environment or the role or leaders that you're working with are really the right fit for you. Because at the end of the day, we serve as role models for others within our organization. And a part of a leadership is positive engagement and ability to speak positively about our organization, show a pride in that organization and show ownership in that organization. And if we can't do that, then we're just mailing it in. And that just doesn't work.
Right. And I suspect the other part of the responsibility is, and you've noted, you know, really understanding the pool of people that report to you or underneath you or more frontline, but also not to sugarcoat what needs to be reported up, right?
Yeah, one of the things I've always found is that people are mature individuals. They deal with a lot of tough issues, both inside and outside of work. And people respond very well to hearing the truth. You can tell the truth in plain terms. You can do so in a respectful manner. But people always want to know how they're doing and how they fit in and how the organization's doing so that they can make their own informed set of decisions. And so by providing that in a very consistent routine manner, that's helpful as a tool. That's why metrics are so important. That's why dashboards are so important. That's by providing a level of transparency and visibility in terms of the total results of an organization and speaking about them and educating people about them is important so that there's a holistic understanding of how an organization is doing and what people can do to help continue that level of performance.
Yeah.
Those are important capabilities to bring to an organization.
So attitude, perspective, the dashboards that provide the metrics, which keeps everything objective and not getting too subjective in terms of people's behaviors and for performance, et cetera.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Jeff. Any other comments about change that I didn't ask you about that's important for the audience to know when you think about change management?
Change is constant. I will share with you my stories in healthcare began as a five-year-old doing house calls with a grandfather in the greater Boston area. And I used to be parked in strangers' kitchens having milk and cookies while my grandfather would disappear into, you know, strangers' bedrooms and living areas to take care of them. And then doing rounds with my dad, who was a surgeon, and seeing over 60 plus years of change before Medicare, after Medicare, cost-based reimbursement, DRGs, APCs, value-based care. Change is a part of healthcare, and change is never going to stop. We can just take a look at the size of healthcare expenditures and our gross domestic product as a country. We can see the budget deficits that are being developed right now. We can see a potential change in leadership after the midterm elections. We can see all that. We understand that policy relates to payment, and we're probably in another cycle of change as we see new policies come down the pike. So we need to understand that change happens all the time within our field. And effective leaders understand that. They're able to communicate that. They're able to adapt to that. And it's a constant part of their DNA. And that's why we never become complacent as change leaders within our field. Because after 60 years of observing healthcare, I have seen enormous change, and that change continues to come along. And we need people who will embrace that, seize on that, and really take an opportunity to leverage the change that's needed in our industry on a go-forward basis. So it's not for the faint of heart. It's not for folks who don't understand that. And if you understand that and bring those skills and positivity, then this is a career for you and an industry that you're going to have a lot of fun and excitement in working in.
Yes. So embrace it, hug it, enjoy it. It's a ride. And that's probably the last point, right? It's a ride. It's not like, okay, we're going to do it and then it's going to be done. No, it's a long-term journey.
Yes, ma'am. No truer words were spoken.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate your being with us today. And I wish you the best in your consulting work and your coaching work.
Thank you, Allison. Same to you.